A drought, by the way, which Spanish priests in their cassocks have described as a punishment from heaven for the de-Christianization of our country in particular, and the world in general, and thus demonstrate your goodwill. Another great silence broke out in the room. Then something came to my mind that had been explained to me in the southern area of the province of Valencia, last autumn, in lands that border on Albastenas. I was told that some small planes, some personal and others rented, commissioned by one of the wealthiest families in the area, exporters of citrus fruits and vegetables and owners of large areas of fruit trees, had seeded clouds loaded with water, in order to drive them away from their lands, which did not need to be irrigated. Well, not only did they achieve their goal, but also another more detestable one, that of driving away from some lands, those of Albacete, towards the sea, the clouds laden with rain. They drove them away from lands where not a single drop of water had fallen for more than a year. This was told to me by a peasant from the Valencian town of Simat de Valdigna, a serious person if ever there was one, and it was confirmed to me by others from the town, also Valencian, of Sumacausal. I was about to tell them, so that they could see that we, despite our modest achievements, have not been doing brilliantly on earth, but, once again, hypocritical earthly prudence prevailed, because the truth is that I felt quite overwhelmed by so many truths that I was remembering, as I chatted with them. And all of them, alas, were justified, and left us worse off each time. In any case, the misdeeds of the cloud-seeding planes are more than enough to show that it is not even necessary to have a war, or to seek out enemies from other nations or planets, for some earthlings to make life impossible for others. In the distance, 6-7 meters away, at the back of the room, to my right, I saw four more crew members, who were moving in front of a large rectangular screen, on which little lights of all colors kept turning on and off, as if they were manipulating buttons on that huge control panel that was at the foot of the luminous screen. Later I would approach it and they would give me all kinds of explanations about it. Suddenly they made me notice, inviting me to approach the large window, that the dome of the ship had separated from it. It was suspended in the air a few meters away. Their ethic of non-interference, it is true, we could do something, they replied, to demonstrate our power. In fact, as you will see later, we have sometimes helped people on the earth, even your fellow countrymen. But that would be ineffective now for several reasons. The first is that the superpowers, in the current state of the world, would end up uniting and launching the slogan of a planetary defense, brandishing the imminence of an extraterrestrial invasion, something like an interstellar crusade, and we have reason to believe that this reaction would not be motivated by our hypothetical intervention in terrestrial affairs, but rather by fear of the insurrection of their own peoples and of the peoples of the Third World, some in protest against this suicidal arms policy of their leaders and others against humiliation and exploitation. Do you understand? The second reason is that, assuming that the two superpowers were to sit on their hands, which is an eventuality that is almost entirely ruled out today, these paternalistic approaches would perhaps be efficient in the short term, but negative in the long term, since any solution coming from heaven would be considered a divine miracle, and this is a farce that we will never agree to. Note that some UFO specialists have already gone so far as to claim that their God Jesus Christ was an extraterrestrial. I recalled, perhaps without rhyme or reason, a Chinese proverb, "The hunger of the people is not satisfied by giving them bread and fish, but by teaching them to sow and fish." Well, the voice continued, "except through a strong and sustained information about the reality of the facts, which would lead us to an unbridled war in space, the superpowers would restrict, adulterate, falsify and even silence that reality, and this for reasons both particular and common at the same time. As is well known, they do so around issues of lesser importance than an intervention on our part in the affairs of the earth, and this would be so, dear comrade, even if we tried to show that we only pursued peaceful ends, without ulterior motives of any kind. Do you understand?" I thought, in passing, of the number of churches and sects that will jump into the fray to score a point. In Spain there are already countless of them, almost all of them the new ones from the Anglo-Saxon area, without forgetting, of course, those mystical revelers, recently coined by the Sevillian Vatican of Palma de Troya. I remained silent for a long time, until the woman who had welcomed me when I arrived at the ship who was sitting in the center of the table broke the silence. "We would like to be well understood and for you to correctly interpret our attitude. We cannot make more gestures of rapprochement, re-establishing of cordial relations, towards you than those we are making to demonstrate our existence and that we are an advanced civilization in all areas. Although it is true that, many times, we have felt the desire to do so, and that is why we talk so often with Earthlings, as we are doing now with you. But we cannot go further until you demonstrate that you truly wish for us to help you. And the first demonstration cannot be other than to put an end to your wars and your coercive and violent practices, even during those times that you call of peace. And we also need to see that the privileged countries of the Earth renounce continuing to dominate and exploit the poor countries, their own planetary brothers. Because if the communities of the Earth," the voice continued, "are not capable of establishing and consolidating an effective and generous solidarity between them, how can we believe in your sincere willingness to integrate into the great cosmic community that we have been illuminating for so many millennia? The unknown treasures of the universe," judging, no doubt, that I needed to relax a little, they invited me on a tour of the ship. I immediately realized that the room I was in was much smaller than I had imagined. There were some partitions that seemed to be made of glass, but practically invisible. I only noticed them when we went through a kind of door and entered what I took to be the navigation and control cabin, if you will, and I heard some very low whistling sounds, which varied in intensity, but always at a very low pitch, in unison with the little lights that flashed on and off intermittently on that huge dashboard, or wall map, that I had already seen from my seat. Now, up close, it seemed more sophisticated, with a series of rows of buttons of different colors, with six little screens embedded in the long desk that extended to the foot of the dashboard. "Press this button, please," one of them said to me, with a hint of a smile on his face. I pressed it and heard perfectly how the Opel's engine started and the headlights came on, while the image of the car was reflected on one of the screens. "Well," I said, "for the sake of saying something, you should know that there is talk out there that you have come to Earth to look for minerals that you lack on your planets. That is just talk for the sake of talk. On our planets there is as much or more variety of minerals and plant and animal species than on Earth. Because our community has the resources of many planets. That is what has allowed us to progress so quickly in our research. In addition to the inexhaustible sources of wealth generated in cosmic space, of which you do not even know how to take advantage of one of many others, solar energy. By a mechanical ramp, identical to the one I used to board a ship, we ascended to the large central room, where, showing me to a table full of pieces of stones, minerals of different sizes, structures and colors, they told me, these rock fragments, and many other samples that we have extracted from the Earth, are to enrich our data and, if the time comes, all this can serve to considerably increase the information that you have about your own planet. However, what helps us progress the most is our knowledge of the laws of cosmic harmony, of the plant, mineral and animal world. And is it true that no one can calculate the treasures of the universe?" I asked with the ignorance of a layman in the matter. "Don't forget that the Earth's seas and your continents are also part of this universe, but we are not used to making any kind of evaluations, so we couldn't answer your question correctly. However, we can assure you that our greatest treasure is the seas and that, without them, both on Earth and on any other planet, it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to continue to have our vital essences in good order. To put it more directly, if the planets dried up, death would take over the universe again. That's why we must take good care of them." Suddenly, for the first time, I began to think about the possible reaction of my fellow Earthlings when I explained all this to them. In truth, up until that moment I don't know why I hadn't stopped to think that I was obliged to explain anything to anyone. Not because of what will they say that doesn't matter a damn to me, but because I feared the uselessness of spreading the details of the meeting and the content of the message. For several hours, all my concern was focused on filing in my mind as many details of that unusual encounter as possible, so as to convince myself that it had not been a dream. Having the message in my possession, a message with unmistakable overtones of an ultimatum, when I thought about how I could best spread it, very contradictory ideas ran through my head. At times I was overcome with great hope, thinking that, with this, I would be able to help my fellow men to see our future more clearly, the one that we ourselves must build with bare chest and bare hands. But at times I also came to fear that perhaps I would contribute to increasing the prevailing confusion around the very fraught subject of extraterrestrials. This last impression was perhaps due to the scant information I had on this subject before the encounter with them. Hence, a contradictory attitude predominated in me, hopeful and pessimistic at the same time. Eventually, at the end of the journey, optimism would win me over again. In the large room I could see four small ships of different types. Two of them were round, like the carrier ship, and the others cylindrical or cigar-shaped types. The first ones were about 10 to 12 meters in diameter and 2.50 to 3 meters high. The others were about 6 to 7 meters long and 2 to 3 meters in diameter. They were, like the mothership, silvery, but dull. The cigars were glazed in, what I took to be, the nose, reminiscent of those I had seen diving into the sea and exploring that underwater cave. The glazed part was like plastic, smoked, which, as I was told, served to see only from the inside out. These ships, one of them added, indicating the round flying saucers are used for surface explorations, when our ship remains suspended in space as a base station. And these, pointing to the cigar-shaped type, are intended for underwater exploration, as you could see in one of the documentaries. Between two columns and in the course of that long conversation interrupted by long and very healthy silences, they invited me to drink a kind of soft drink that tasted like orange, lemon and grapefruit at the same time. And I also had a meal with them, which consisted of taking several tablets. In other words, synthetic food, so to speak. But after it, I had the feeling of having eaten well. Aliens in a Spanish sea village. Showing me a corner console, he said, "Take a seat and pay attention, please." We sat down and, immediately, the light filtered and on a screen which came out of the ceiling and remained suspended at mid-height two cylindrical ships appeared. They flew quickly at sea level, very low above the waves. Suddenly they stopped and, diving from the nose, they slowly plunged into the sea, through the glass window, and thanks to its extremely slow speed, always with the same objective, not to disturb the aquatic environment more than minimally, I was able to admire the underwater depths, with all its fine and multicolored flora and the abundant and varied fauna that played around the small ships, while inside, and with their noses pressed against the glass, I could see several crew members, who seemed to be having fun like children watching all those fish. Shortly afterwards, under a splendid moonlight, the ships surfaced, approaching a deserted beach. Minutes later, coming from inland, two groups of extraterrestrials appeared, carrying a kind of backpack on their backs. But as they came closer, I could see that they were joined by Earthlings, who, when they reached the seashore, where the waves break up, would greet them with great displays of affection, waving caps and handkerchiefs. There must have been about 15 or 20 people of both sexes, among whom were several children, until the cylindrical ships sank back into the sea. It was clear that they were not at all surprised to see them. I was perplexed, not knowing what to say. At times I began to suspect that it might all be a setup, and to convince myself that it was not, I asked, "So it seems that this ongoing contact must actually have already been established, since, as I have seen, this group of men and women seem to be accustomed to your visits." "Exactly. We have established contact with countless isolated groups of Earthlings and sometimes with families who live in very remote places, and they all help us in our investigations. In exchange for what? I cut her off, immediately regretting having asked her such a question. You're welcome, in exchange for nothing. Well, actually, in exchange for our gratitude, because deep down, both us and them know that we are working for a common cause. And could you tell me what country these people are from? From yours, dear friend, from Spain. They are part of a seafaring population from your Mediterranean coasts, the Andalusians, specifically. I could almost have guessed, without being able to be sure, although they could also be Italian or Greek. But no, according to them they were Spanish. And there was no reason not to believe them. The film session was suspended and then they invited me to go up to the dome, completely transparent, through which the starry sky could be seen. I don't know what kind of glass the dome was made of, but the truth is that I had the feeling that that sky was within my reach. The we climbed a spiral ramp and then I noticed that something kept me at all times around 30 centimeters away from them. When you talk to someone, you tend to even grab them by the arm. So that, unconsciously, I tried to get closer to them on several occasions, but, I repeat, I always noticed that something, like a warm vapor barrier, was holding me back. A small space wobble. Do you realize one of them said to me, that we have already separated from the ship? Approaching one of the large glass windows, I noticed that we were up in the air, next to the ship, about 5 or 6 meters from it. I confess that, at that moment, I was afraid, because I was afraid that they would decide to take off with the dome since, apparently, the ship could fragment and each piece could transform into an autonomous space vehicle. I went from surprise to surprise. And although I am, in technical matters, only on a rather basic level, at times I thought about the faces of our great aerospace specialists if they could observe the ease with which they evolve, transform, dissolve, restructure and remain suspended in the air, laughing, so to speak, at our laws of gravity and who knows how many more laws. But no, there was no flight, just a modest spatial wobble, since, within a few minutes, we were going to be stuck again at the top of the ship, without me having the sensation of having moved. Of course, everything was happening very fast but my thoughts were sluggish after all, they were no more than those of a temporarily frightened Earthling. Meanwhile, before returning to our starting point one of them invited me to come closer to the glass wall of the dome, and shortly afterwards I realized that the mothership was opening up over some base to allow the two round flying saucers I had seen in the earlier to take flight. I saw them take off a few seconds apart silently, with a great number of little lights, turning on and off with rapid flashes around the ships. And where are those ships going? To pick up some exploration teams we had left in some mountains in central France. Later, catching up on UFOs, I was able to confirm that the powerful aircraft and impressive rocketry available to the most important armies on Earth have never managed to intercept, let alone shoot down or capture, a single one of these ships. Nor is there any record of any damaged ships. Which would confirm the great impression of security that they gave me at all times, although I must clarify that not once did they appear presumptuous, and they could afford to. But it is clear to me that the citizens of the cosmos come and go, land and take off, explore, dive into our seas and lakes, in a word, they walk around our space and our planet, as if they were at home. Oh. And they settle in our mountains and live and chat with Earthlings for as long as they like. We then went back down to the room with the illuminated board and I noticed that there were two bottles and several thick drinking glasses on the table. We sat down and they asked me if I was thirsty. I was not really thirsty or hungry, but to see what they would give me, I said yes and they served me a pink, somewhat thick liquid. When I tasted it I thought it was orange juice, but then, as I drank it, I had the sensation that it had an acidic aftertaste, like lemon or grapefruit juice. Then, I don't know if it was because of the influence of the drink or what, but I felt a slight drowsiness. I think I fell asleep for a while. I couldn't say if the question that had obsessed me the most that night, what to do with getting their message out, came back to haunt me while I was awake or during that short nap I took. I thought I should jettison it as quickly as possible, under a pseudonym, accompanied, of course, by a story that would make it credible. But little by little, I discarded this idea because it had shades of cowardice and discourtesy towards those who had entrusted it to me. I also thought of entrusting it to some personality in the world of politics or literature. Choosing the person carefully, of course. Then I remembered Orson Welles' radio broadcast in 1938 in the United States, announcing, with an apocalyptic atmosphere, that the Martians were invading the planet Earth, and I imagined that, with the help of some radio friend, we could put together a similar broadcast, only, instead of frightening people, ours would serve to spread their information widely. It should not have been difficult to organize a round table, as if they were among us, to give the event a well-adjusted sensationalism that would help to make the message hit home, firstly, among the listeners and, by extension, in public opinion. I even planned to foist the package on the main tenant of the Zazzler Palace, and on his wife, apparently very interested in the UFO phenomenon, since they were, as I saw, considered particularly pleasant people. Possibly because they knew that they had a UFO advisor in the person of the journalist writer J.J. Benitez. I confess that it also crossed my mind to put the message in a folder and keep it for myself. That way we would see if they respected my freedom of decision, or if they were capable of forcing me, by manipulating me or programming me, it makes no difference, to make it public. In both cases, what never escaped me at any time, the lessons I have learned throughout my eventful existence must be of some use to me, were the dangers that such dissemination could entail. All these reflections, like all those I made during my stay on the ship Light of the Cosmos, while I chatted with them, admired their films or shared their silences, would have been impossible for me, I think, to make an unearthly time span or without them having prepared my mind, as they had already warned me, to concentrate such a sum of impressions and sensations on it. As memories, reflections, images paraded by, I was more and more amazed, because, thinking of my fellow countrymen on Earth, I told myself that if all of them were put in a position to use their capacity for perception to the maximum, if we were to observe, reflect and analyze, so that all these individual powers would increase harmoniously, then it would be conducive to allowing our lives to flow more placidly, without transforming a banal setback into an insurmountable turmoil. What we call unnecessarily complicating life, which, it has already been said, but it will not be out of place to repeat it here, is the most characteristic sign of our civilization, populating human lives with innumerable difficulties, illnesses, traumas, depressions, ghosts and other despairs, so that human beings do not get off track in their entire existence. As I passed by them, I also looked at them, one by one, in the eyes, fixedly, and I am sure that they realized that, with my gaze, I was thanking them from the depths of myself. I noticed that in their gazes, as never before, an immense, untranslatable kindness was reflected. I was so impressed that I was about to turn around, sit down again and continue chatting with them until the end of my days. "Will we see each other again?" I asked. "It is quite possible," answered the one who, hours before, had welcomed me aboard their ship. "Abductions of Earthmen." Suddenly it occurred to me to ask them a question. "Forgive the indiscretion, but what is the truth about these abductions of Earthmen that you are accused of?" "Well, that depends on how you look at it. We do not believe that is the correct description. We should rather speak of rescue. Look carefully at what we are going to show you and judge for yourself." In fractions of a second we found ourselves immersed again in another cinematographic projection. It was as if we were traveling on board a helicopter. Well, I forgot that their ships can fly through space at high speeds, but also at the speed of a scooter, or remain motionless and suspended in the air indefinitely. Now we were descending vertically and slowly. At first glance it seemed to me that we were diving over some rice fields or a large expanse of swampy ponds. Soon I saw some groups of men and women working in those flooded fields, with the water up to their knees. This is the planet Yerba Fina, they told me. Take a good look at those people and tell us if they remind you of anything. When we got a few meters from the ground, the ship circled around the farmers several times and they, getting up, waved to us joyfully with their hands. I immediately saw some faces that, if they were not familiar to me, were not completely unknown either. And I exclaimed, but they are people from India. There were about 100 of them. And they were working in some rice fields. For a few minutes we flew slowly over those fields and their surroundings. Now look carefully at these are their agricultural works. And on the screen appeared large extensions of land. They told me it was the planet Golden Wheat and I saw something like a dozen and a half very low tractors, tilling some rather brownish land, as if sprinkled with slate dust. Those contraptions reminded me, for a moment, of the diabolical Italian light tanks, the Ansaldo, Fiat, of the Spanish War. In one corner of that immense field I saw a kind of round tent, as if it were inflated. From that canvas house they told me, those tractors and any other agricultural machinery are driven. If we want, we can completely mechanize the farm work. What happens is that there are people who want to do it the old way, like those men and women of Yerba Fina, who expressed the desire to continue growing rice as they did in their land, and since that seems to make them happy, they have been allowed to do so. But their children, who are already receiving the double training necessary and vocational, will surely one day wish to have more free time to travel, explore, investigate. Because those people are from India, indeed, said another of the pilots. They were rescued on an islet formed by one of the terrible floods that occur in that country, when it became clear that they would be swallowed by the waters of a flooded river. One of our ships was on an observation mission there, which, after consulting with its space, descended on that islet and rescued them. There were about 1,000 people. This happened a long time ago and it was the first time that a crew from our fraternity took on such a mission. As soon as they entered the ship, they were put in a state of cosmic rest, while we investigated how and where they could be brought back to active life. They rested for a long time, until we managed to tune their organisms to the planet on which they were going to live and work. Then we transferred them to Yerba Fina, which is a planet with characteristics very similar to Earth, to their land. And, with a hint of irony, he added, but without their epidemics, nor their misery and, as you may have seen, without their sacred cows. Well, it seems to me that I saw some. Yes, there are cows, but not sacred. Here, in our communities, everything is sacred, as you would say, people, seas, animals, rivers, lakes, plants. In a word, everything that breathes life deserves respect and veneration. And you have only rescued Hindus? No, not at all. On other planets there live people from Africa, Europe, Latin America, Oceania, Australasia, Melanesia, Micronesia, and Polynesia, and Central Asia. I wanted to ask them if the rescues of Earthlings were limited to people of humble condition and in particular from rural areas. Hours later, when I had already left the ship, heading towards Barcelona, I thought that I could have asked them 1,000 things, how they managed without a state, without prisons or banks, without police, without military, without currency or civil servants, without psychologists, economists, philosophers, slot machines, sociologists, or psychoanalysts. In short, without those immense fairs of vanity that are the festivals, the contests, the charity parties, the biennials, the political tournaments, the social echoes, the poetic literary meetings, the boxing evenings, the Eurovisions, the sports championships, with the Olympic Games as the biggest farce, the social collections, the state charity, or without the pools, named, for greater shame, charity sport, the sex shops, the discos, the lottery, the opium smokers, the casinos, the terrifying gadgets, and the chains of brothels, the greatest shame of any civilization, and all that mafia trickery that some call the greasy pole of life, without stopping to consider that very few benefit from this greasy pole, the crooks and the chosen ones. As always,